Welcome to Signs of the Times, a look at recent world events from around our kitchen table. British journalist Jonathan Steele, writing for the UK Guardian, wrote, "In the United States, more people have guns than passports." Tonight on the Signs of the Times podcast, we have two special reports prepared by Ryan from Australia.
Well, that quote is quite interesting, Henry, because David Hicks, major Australian figure who is currently in Guantanamo Bay under the usual trumped-up US crimes, is mentioned to his lawyer that his mother never formally applied for Australian citizenship, and thus there is a possible legal avenue for him to take the same route of escape that several other British terror suspects have taken, given that the British government seems to apply a little more force in protecting its citizens from the war crimes or violations of the Geneva Convention that are currently occurring in Guantanamo Bay. And the Australian Foreign Minister had some interesting things to say about this. He will apparently be dodging justice if he gets out of Guantanamo Bay via British citizenship, says Foreign Minister Alexander Downer. Now, I don't know about you, but I feel very reassured that I have a man of such integrity who'd be willing to stand behind me as an Australian citizen if the US drops me into some kind of prison camp.
And what exactly is David Hicks accused of, Ryan?
He was arrested by American forces in Afghanistan for training, allegedly with Al-Qaeda terrorists. However, there has been little solid evidence beyond a few photographs to prove that he was in any way planning or conspiring any kind of terrorist attack against either Australians or US or British citizens. There was talk on the internet that he apparently was training via some Muslim connections in order to help the rebels in Chechnya in their struggle against the Russians. He pled not guilty before a US military commission last year to conspiracy, aiding the enemy, and attempted murder. However, a trial date has yet to be set for him to answer these charges.
Okay, so the fundamental problem, really, and we have to go back to the origins of Al-Qaeda here, is that the people that the US government claims to be this international network of Islamic terrorists have their origins back in Afghanistan, and really in what it's known today as the Taliban, back in the mid-70s, mid to late 70s and early 80s. It was a very small group of fundamentalist Islamic kind of clerics, I suppose, would have been known or are known as, who were employed essentially by the CIA to fight against the Russians, who the CIA and the American government of the time had enticed into Afghanistan by US presence in Afghanistan. And they then armed and financed these Taliban essentially with billions of dollars of American taxpayers' money, supplied them with arms and intelligence and training, etc. So the CIA formed their own mercenary army made up of these fundamentalist Islamic clerics who and their supporters to fight their guerrilla wars for the American interest around the globe, starting in Afghanistan and then moving on in later years into Bosnia and into Chechnya. So the idea that this guy is being accused of fighting in Chechnya against the Russians, if you want to go right back to the people who are responsible for this, you have to say that the responsibility lies with the CIA. So, but then that's nothing new, because as we've seen through many different reports and our own research, the global terror network has been, as we're saying, has been funded and set up by CIA and Israeli intelligence agencies.
And there's a movement in Australia led by David Hicks' father that claims that all the charges against him are pretty much poppycock. And he is being held as a political prisoner in order to give the US some kind of legitimacy
In their war on terror.
War on terror, yes.
Yeah, but because, of course, to convince the world, the American public and the world public that the terrorist, Islamic terrorist threat is real, they have to have, you know, some bodies in prisons and some people up in court and some people accused of carrying out this terrorism, because they can't very well claim that there is a worldwide Islamic terrorist threat if there's no one kind of to take that responsibility. So, I mean, really the idea is, while it might seem amazing or fantastic to a lot of people, the simple truth is that these people are being used essentially as patsies to, as you say, to justify the, or to create the reality of an Islamic terrorist threat. And the interesting thing about it is that in a news story just this week, the US courts have, or the US government, there's not much difference these days between the US government and the US Supreme Courts, they have denied Venezuela's request for convicted terrorist bomber Carriles. They have denied Venezuela's request to have him extradited back to Venezuela to answer the charges that he, the pretty conclusive charges that he blew up a Cuban airliner in 1976. Now, this guy, by anybody's estimation, is a real terrorist. And the fact, of course, is that he was also a CIA agent at the time. So what we have here is a bomber of a Cuban airliner full of people employed by the CIA, who's now ensconced in the U.S., and the U.S. government is refusing to extradite him or hand him over to Venezuela to answer these charges. So we have to ask ourselves what is the real motivation of the Bush government here in terms of fighting a war on terror when they have this this verifiable terrorist and bomber of an airliner and they're essentially protecting him. So, you know, I mean, there's a very obvious claim. That's really the problem here, is that there's such blatant double standards and the evidence for the falsity of the entire war on terror as it's being touted by the Bush regime is so completely and obviously false and verifiably false that it's amazing that that so many people still do not get it, you know, do not see the reality of the situation. It's really getting to the point where people like us who are writing on the Signs of the Times and writing articles about this, and many other websites who are doing the same thing, really must be getting exasperated with the situation as it is, because, as we say, there is so much evidence there. It's really black and white at this stage, but still the fog of disbelief and of delusion seems to be hanging over so much of the world, and so many people seem to either unable or unwilling to actually just accept facts, and that's something that we want to explore maybe in this week's podcast, which is the idea of why people, why the average citizens around the world have such a hard time actually accepting the reality of the situation. Of course, there's several possible answers to that question, but there may be a fundamental answer as well, which we'll maybe get to a little later on.
Well, now that you put the topic on the table, why don't we deal with it right away? Because it is a rather important question. Looking at Americans on that point, one of the things that's always struck me is a certain lack of curiosity on the part of many, many Americans of anything that goes on outside of the borders of their own country. As you say, it's as if the rest of the world doesn't exist. You look at American news, and the reports that they have on American news about other countries are always from the point of view of how it affects America, and anything that goes on in these countries that doesn't touch U.S. interests is ignored. And so how can a population be well formed in anything if they don't get the data, the information that they need to be able to formulate an opinion.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and something that, you know, any American listeners who haven't actually, you know, traveled that much, or maybe even haven't been out of the U.S., really need to know that from the perspective of someone outside of the U.S., there really has been a one way flow of information over the decades in terms of information about the rest of the world and about other cultures and stuff. People in Europe for the past 20, 30, 40 years have all been receiving via radio and TV and advertising and publicity. They've been receiving essentially American propaganda or information on American, about American TV shows, American radio shows, generally information on American life, etc., etc. And there's been very little going back the ways, you know. And
I read an interesting remark many years ago about, it was an analysis of ads and publicity around the world. I was saying that the difference between, say, the way Americans market their products and the way the Japanese would market their cars, for example. And it was saying that for many, many, many years, since the Second World War, in effect, what is being marketed when the United States markets its products abroad is the American way of life. Is you buy this product and then you too will be able to be, you know, have access to the American way of life. Whereas for the Japanese, they were simply selling a car.
Yeah, and that's, you know, obviously that's that we assume, and it's a reasonable assumption that has been a deliberate strategy with the backing of the government, but obviously mainly by the corporations within the U.S. And it's been a very slow process over the years, but it's definitely been a tactic that the U.S. government and the U.S. U.S. corporations have used to essentially affect their at that level anyway, an economic domination of the globe, because, you know, you export your propaganda about American way of life, and on the back of that you export American businesses, for example McDonald's and Burger King and Levi Jeans, etc., etc. And in this way the American government was able to infiltrate many markets around the world with American kind of, you know, products and garner generate an awful lot of revenue from that, and as we say there has been very little going back the ways, and obviously that's not a natural state of affairs, because you would assume that in an open market that there would be a lot of flow back the ways, where you would have products from other countries and advertising and information about those countries going back to America. But as we've seen, even up to the present day, in the so-called information age, when supposedly all of this information is available, so many Americans are completely unaware about the geography or the position on the globe of other countries, let alone products from other countries or aspects of cultures of other countries.
And the link between, say, exporting of a culture and then trade is well known, and this has been talked about. In fact, a United States senator back in, I think it was 1919, made the remark about exporting U.S. films abroad, was saying, you know, first we send over the films and trade will follow. So this is not something that's haphazard or anything. This is a planned strategy on the part of politicians and business people in the United States, and it has been now for, you know, over 80 years.
But is it the case that that other cultures and other countries did not engage in the same type of economics, or is it that there was a deliberate campaign of blocking of these aspects of other cultures?
Oh, well, obviously, in the United States, things are blocked. They love to talk about the market and allowing the market and this and that, but any country that's gone in to try to trade with the United States finds out very, very quickly that the United States is extremely protectionist. Last week, Lynn from Canada was talking about the softwood trade issue, and Canadians are very, very aware and sensitive to this issue because the United States uses every means in its power to block a lot of Canadian materials coming into the country. You look at using the the mad cow disease to prevent Canadian beef. There's the softwood lumber that we've talked about.
And indeed, also the tariffs under the Australian-US Free Trade Agreement, which block the full economic benefits of the export of Australian beef and sugar to the US for a number of years, giving the US producers a clear economic advantage.
And then at the same time, within the United States, there's this patriotic feeling that says we need to buy American. And although this is going on one level as a kind of propaganda campaign among the people, at the same time, more and more and more of the products are being made elsewhere than in the United States, but they're coming from countries like China. But then when China recently tried to purchase an oil company in the United States, there was an uproar, and the Chinese bid was refused. But if the United States goes into any country and those countries try to prevent an American from purchasing a company in another country, then the United States gets on its high horse and gets upset and then starts talking about free trade and freedom of capital to circulate and all that.
So how does all of that tie in to the current status? I mean, we just want to bring it back to the susceptibility of particularly of Americans to the simplistic black and white propaganda that is being forced on them at the minute and has over the past few years about the war on terror and then the so-called clash of civilizations, where Americans seem so willing to accept very simplistic notions of good and evil and right and wrong. And I mean, the rhetoric coming out of Bush's mouth has just been nauseating, and you know, it doesn't just border on the ridiculous, it goes well beyond the ridiculous, but no one seems to call him on it. And we wonder if you know, no one in the press is actually saying Bush is, you know, full of crap, but we wonder, are ordinary Americans thinking that, ordinary Americans, you know, listening to that kind of stuff and just falling over laughing as they should be?
It's hard to generalize, but there is a class structure in the United States, and people from the rich, the elite, the upper class, they do receive an education that talks to them about the rest of the world. They may go over and do studies in the rest of the world. They're encouraged to go off and travel a bit because they're the ones who will later be running the country, and they do need to know something about the rest of the world. It's when you get below that that the difficulties come, and I think there are many different reasons that work into it on different levels. The education system, and the public education system for most people, is absolutely atrocious. Another thing is that many, many people can't afford to travel. In doing some research for this, I was reading a website that was talking about, it was trying to establish what percentage of Americans had passports, and there was some discussion on it stretching back over several years. Over Americans' passports travel, how many Americans travel. And there were several entries in the discussion from people who said, you know, geez, you know, we'd really love to travel, but say, I've had 1 week of paid vacation in my whole life, or, you know, it's well known in the rest of the world that Americans have ridiculously low amounts of paid vacation every year. With the economic climate as it is now, where people are really living hand to mouth and week to week, waiting for the paychecks, and where getting sick can put them into bankruptcy, people don't have the money to travel, at least to places like you know, Europe or Asia. People were saying that they were able to travel either into Canada or to Mexico because they could drive, and so it was cheaper. With rising oil costs, that's, of course, is going to be limited as well. And then there's just, as you were mentioning earlier, the socialization, the idea that everything there is in the United States. In the United States, there are mountains, there's deserts, there's oceans, there's you know, amber waves of grain and deserts, and so why do we need to go somewhere else? We have it all here. When you think about that comment a bit, you see how limited it is, because it's reducing the rest of the world to some sort of a landscape, and the way people live, what people do, is of no interest to them, which gets back to my comment earlier about the lack of curiosity. There was another comment that I read by a man who lives in West Texas, and he was saying how fed up he was hearing people talk about you know, Americans not traveling and not being interested in other cultures. And he said he could drive 800 miles to the east and he'd still be in Texas, but there'd be a different climate and there'd be a different culture. Now, what kind of cultural differences are there really between eastern Texas and western Texas?
When shapes of cowboy hats, maybe?
When you compare it.
You only get lethal injection instead of gassing for your death penalty.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the spectrum of difference and variety that makes this world becomes completely limited to such a small range. And it's the same thing we see in American politics, where you have the Republicans and you have the Democrats. And if you were to take those two political parties and put them in a European country, or even put them in Canada, you'd see that there's no difference, that they're the same. And so the political choice is really, really limited, but they've been so conditioned that they think that within this binary choice between Republicans and Democrats, they're free. And it seems to be the same thing with culture. Well, I can go to East Texas and I can see that it's different from West Texas, and I've expanded my mind.
Hmm. But it also brings up the idea of there being, or that there should be, an innate curiosity within people.
Yeah.
That I mean, certainly most Americans are aware that there is a big world out there, and you know, lots of different people with different languages and different cultures. But why? I mean, does it come down to the idea that there are just certain maybe two different types of people in a way, or that there are some people who just naturally reject the idea that America has everything, you know, because it's pretty plain to them when they look at a map that, or look at you know, the limited TV, even that there are some serious differences between the rest of the world and America, and that they're interested in exploring those, whereas other people, I suppose it might come down to a fundamental response to the idea of difference.
Mm-hmm.
And that some people are you know,
excited
or attracted by differences and want to kind of explore those and expand their own understanding.
Yep.
And other people whose response is really one of fear, mm-hmm. where they're afraid of anything that's different, or maybe they've been told that anything different is something to be afraid of. But it's a kind of a thorny issue of whether it's been socialized into most people, or whether it's naturally in people. There's a difference between different types of people, or maybe it's a mixture of both.
No, I think having lived the majority of my life in America, there is definitely a certain xenophobia that's rather prevalent, and it's also kind of hard for me to actually put my finger on the exact cause of it. Certainly, I think that the fact that the educational system is in you know, there have been numerous people who have examined, you know, the educational systems of various countries, including the U.S., and inevitably every study concludes that as time has progressed, the American educational system has deteriorated to the point of absurdity. Just to give a little example of how powerful the xenophobia and the propaganda can be in terms of relating to other countries, you know, when I was in high school, I took a French class, and of course you learn about, well, supposedly, you know, you learn about the culture, and there was a great deal of information about, you know, how the French people live, and you know, the structure of their society, and what French people are like, and you know, how they live their lives. And so I had a friend who happened to move to France. And so this person sent an email and said that she was going into, had to go to market to buy some food. And even though I knew that, you know, in fact, they don't use horse-drawn carriages, they actually have cars in France and, you know, that kind of thing, the vision that I had in my head was of sort of like a medieval times, and there were like dirt roads, and that she was going to like an open-air market, and there were like all these people who were like selling, you know, fruits and vegetables and like, you know, live chickens, and people were pushing like their little wheeled carts along. And I mean, I knew that that was just like totally like stupid.
No, there's one of those up the road.
You know, so this is just sort of an example of, you know, even though I knew that this was not the way it was, the first thing that comes to my mind is this totally backwards, you know, type of society, and you know, they don't have indoor plumbing, and
this is maybe 30 years ago. There was a thing that when you go to Europe, even to countries like France or Germany, if you're an American, you're supposed to bring your own toilet paper.
Yeah.
Because the toilet paper in Europe still had pieces of wood in it or something.
Shrapnel.
And so given that, you know, when I learned history in school, and, you know, I had the opportunity to go to better schools, and I mean, even for example, the history that I learned was just so completely skewed, so pro-American and xenophobic, and
I had an experience like that because I was born in the States before fleeing when I was 18 to go to Canada during the Vietnam years. And one year when I was in high school, I started the year in a private school and I finished the year in a public school. And the history course that we were having in the private school dealt with issues, things like the Jim Crow laws, and trying to get some understanding on a deeper level than just facts and figures of what was going on and what were the forces that were shaping the country back in the early days. And then when I got into the public school, I was in a history course, and it was all about dates. It was all about who the famous men were, when they were born, when they died, what was the date of this battle, what was the date of that battle. And it was a very, very clear illustration of the difference in level of education between, as I was saying earlier, the one class and the other.
It's sort of easy to understand how when you're when the educational system is so awful that, you know, when you're not really educated about other cultures, when you're not encouraged to expose yourself to other cultures in terms of, you know, not just some words in a book and the idea that the people who wrote the textbooks want you to have, but the real idea. And of course, every time you're exposed to such a culture, for example, in the French class I took, it's almost like there's a focus on how much better America is. And in every way. And so it's very easy to see how this sort of fear of other cultures is programmed into people. And then, of course, you have the fact that in America, the, you know, like, you know, they have less vacation. Well, you know, in many European countries, the you know, spending time with your family and having a life basically is a part of the culture. There's a very long history. It seems to me that whereas in Europe, for example, you might have a focus on basically having a life. And for example, as Henry said, in Japan, you know, they're just buying a car. In America, you're buying, you know, this ideal of
it's going to make your life perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And so where there's, you know, and then, of course, you've got this guy in Texas who says, you know, he goes to West Texas and it's a different culture. So whereas you have this sort of dilution of, you know, the idea of culture, you also have kind of like this, you know, it's like the idea of like life is distilled down in America to having stuff.
So what you're really saying is in the United States, freedom is equated with the freedom to choose between a Coke and a Pepsi.
Yeah, basically, and that everyone who doesn't have something, their sole focus in life is to have what their neighbor has, and when that's your primary concern, and when you know nothing of other cultures, you know, obviously, if you want stuff, you're going to support all these crazy economic policies, and you've been taught to be basically terrified, and you have all these preconceived notions, so you're terrified of other cultures. You don't want to travel anywhere. Everything you need is right there, and you're basically brainwashed into, well, thinking you're happy.
Well, this comes back to the issue that Joe raised earlier about this fundamental difference. Is there a fundamental difference in people? Are there people who are curious, and are there people who are not? And is it more than just socialization? Does it come down to genetics? Does it come down to who somebody is on a level of their soul?
Yeah, well, I mean, just getting back to the idea, I mean, to be fair, if that's possible, to Americans, I mean, compared to Europe, I mean, people in Europe have, by the very nature of Europe and the various countries that are there within a relatively small kind of piece of land, people in Europe who grew up, are born and grew up in Europe, are immediately exposed to diversity right on their borders, and a lot of diversity in terms of language and culture and other people and dress, etc., etc. So there's a complexity there that people in Europe are immediately exposed to, whereas in the US there isn't that complexity. There is basically just the US, and okay, so the US shares a border with Canada, but I mean, you know, in terms of complexity, i.e. culture and language, there isn't much difference from an American's point of view between America and Canada. Okay, they also
most Americans have no idea that there are several million French-speaking people living just across the border.
But they also share a border with Mexico, albeit a relatively small border, but they know that there's another country there. But they have these stereotypes about Mexicans as well, and the thing is that anybody that comes to the U.S. from Mexico or comes from other countries around the world is coming there to speak English, to join the great kind of capitalist game where they can be who they want to be and be the best and be the greatest, and they can be president if they want, they're told, right? So all of that, once you cross into the US, any diversity is immediately kind of diluted, or it's people dilute their own diversity to this kind of general American culture that they're all very much aware of already because of the years of exporting of American culture, let's say. And of course, it also ties into the fact that Europe has a long history of wars and of exchange of peoples from different countries. So, in the education system in European countries, you have people are exposed and they can't not be exposed to the existence and the reality of other countries, because at one stage or another, one country was either invaded or invaded in another country. So people are aware of this and aware of a shared kind of a history there, which. Okay, the U.S. it was owned by, it was ruled by Britain or by the U.K. by the United Kingdom for a number of years, but that was very short lived. And the thing is, I suppose the fundamental point here is that maybe the fundamental difference is that the U.S. has a very short history. It's almost like it gets to the round to the idea of. That the U.S. was essentially an experiment, that you had, you know, and this gets into kind of deep into conspiracy theory again, or I don't know, you might even say it's generation spanning kind of manipulations by a certain clique or power elite, but that the U.S. back 200, 250 years ago was consciously chosen by certain peoples for what it has become today, an experiment in extreme capitalism and aggression and belligerence and being the policeman of the world, etc. Everything that has come to pass, particularly over the past five years. And the other very important point, I think, about the US is the whole idea of patriotism. Because while there might be many Americans who are aware of other cultures and the differences between the US and other countries and other peoples around the world. When it comes down to it, when patriotism is shoved in their face, when the idea of it's either you're with us or against us, and that we're spreading great American values around the world, and this is what you know, this is what kids and people in the U.S. as children have been brought up with, you know, kissing the flag or standing up in school and reciting the
Pledge of Allegiance,
the Pledge of Allegiance, and singing the national anthem every morning. Obviously, patriotism is a major factor here, and it's deliberately done in that way. With a view to producing adults who will have this already ingrained in them, and they're not aware of it. I mean, they think it's just part of who they are. It's that they're patriotic citizens. They're true Americans, and they're going to support their country and everything that's right. And they're not necessarily negative ideas or ideals for someone to hold. But what people have to look at is what's really behind this whole idea of patriotism and what the government is doing in the name of patriotism.
How that ideal of patriotism is being used by the power elites.
Yeah, and they're manipulating a genuine essence or a genuine a feeling that people have within them, you know, for their home, and to albeit in a misinformed way, they're supporting this idea of spreading freedom and democracy, etc. But I mean, it doesn't take much to realize that that's all just a complete manipulation, and there's nothing behind it, nothing of any truth behind that idea of spreading freedom and democracy.
And for listeners who think that the idea that the United States is a social experiment carried out by someone that started 250 years ago, if you find that outlandish, we would encourage you to get our new book on 9/11, The Ultimate Truth, where we go and we show that, in fact, the roots of the 9/11 false flag operation stretch back many, many thousands of years into the period when Judaism was established and all of the monotheistic religions. You can order the book 9/11, The Ultimate Truth, from the website of the publisher, Red Pill Press, www.redpillpress.com. To close this week's show, we'd just like to talk about the most recent fireballs that were seen in Florida this week. There's been a couple of them in Florida in the last couple of weeks, and a friend of ours at Away with the Fairies has written a little song about it. Space rocks keep falling on my head.
A song that may turn out to be prophetic in more ways than one.
Well, thank you for joining us, and as always, if you'd like to read more on the topics we discussed today, you can go to our website at www.signs-of-the-times.org. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Self.